the case of People, Walter Tate versus People of the State of Colorado, case number 2011 SC382. Are both parties ready?
Yes.
A few housekeeping matters. First, the argument is set for an hour, half an hour aside, and the petitioner will have to keep track of your own time. When you present your argument, please tell us who you are and who you represent. And then one other matter, some of us are using iPads, and so for the benefit of the lawyers and the audience, I want you to know that we're not surfing. We have all the briefs and all our notes on the iPad, and we're able to link to cases that the lawyers cite, as well as to parts of the record. And so that's what's going on up here while we're doing this. With that, we'll begin. We'll hear from the petitioner.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please counsel, may it please the court. My name is Jennifer Longton, attorney registration number 43509. And along with my co-counsel, Mr. Nicholas Sarwark, attorney registration 40608, both from the Office of the Public Defender, we represent Mr. Tate. At this time, we would humbly ask to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal by Mr. Sarwark.
You understand you have to.
I do, Your Honor. I just wanted to give the court a little bit of a roadmap. Thank you. This case is about giving full effect to the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution. The issue before the court is whether an individual's right to be free from an unreasonable seizure goes away when they fall asleep. This honorable court should uphold the trial court's original suppression ruling, overturning the decision made by the district court, and find that Officer Benda seized Mr. Tate when he parked behind his car, fully blocking him in and preventing him from terminating the police encounter. The fact that Mr. Tate was asleep does not change the longstanding objective reasonable person standard in this area of law. And finally, that when this seizure occurred, Officer Benda lacked the requisite reasonable suspicion to seize Mr. Tate in a constitutional manner. I'll first address the seizure itself. Mr. Tate was seized when Officer Benda parked his car in the area directly behind Mr. Tate's vehicle. Mr. Tate's vehicle was blocked in on three sides by other parked cars in a residential parking lot. The officer pulled in behind him only mere feet from his bumper and completely boxed in his vehicle, preventing him from leaving.
Well, he couldn't leave anyway. He was asleep, right?
I don't disagree with the court, but I would also say he could leave. He just chose not to as he was sleeping at the time. But had he awoken at any moment, he could leave until Officer Benda parked his car behind Mr. Tate.
But when the officer goes up to the vehicle, he sees the beer cans and evidence that he may have been driving or about to drive intoxicated, right?
And, Your Honor, I would concede that at the time the officer knocks on the window and sees the beer cans, that there is reasonable suspicion for a DUI stop.
So your only point is he should have parked somewhere else? Well, there wasn't any other place to park. There was only one space, and that was the one behind the car, right?
No, Your Honor. I would disagree with the court on that. I think the record's clear that this was a residential parking spot. There were other parking spaces, and there was other road because there were unoccupied cars on either side of Mr. Tate. The officer could have easily pulled even behind one of those cars. But to directly address the court's question, what I would state is that if this is a stop for or a check, like a welfare check, all the officer had to do was park somewhere else, because there's no reasonable suspicion for a welfare check. There has to be reasonable suspicion for a seizure.
Ms. Longton, Do you think that the Fourth Amendment should be involved in telling police officers where to park?
I do, Your Honor.
Why?
Because the Fourth Amendment protects our liberty interests, and it protects someone from being seized and their liberty being restrained without reasonable suspicion. And there is case law to back up the proposition that when someone parks behind a vehicle that's boxed in on all sides, that is a seizure under the Fourth Amendment. I would cite to the Gross case and the C case, Your Honor.
Do you think that case law you're referring to indicates that's a seizure, even if the person who's in the car or is being seized is not aware of it? And is that the initial question, whether seizure is defined in terms of awareness?
I do agree with Your Honor that there is a serious question. Obviously, the question before the court today is whether that awareness falls under the objective test. I would state that awareness is not an element in the objective reasonable person standard. It can be somewhat referred to as a state of mind, but more than that, a person's awareness does not affect their constitutional rights in other areas. So I don't necessarily see why it should in this area.
And so in the language of the test, when we talk about whether a reasonable person in the defendant's situation would feel that he was not free to leave, you would interpret that as meaning a reasonable person in the defendant's situation minus the fact that the defendant is asleep?
Yes, I would, Your Honor. I believe that there are propositions that it's an objective test. It does not take into account the state of mind of the individual being seized. And furthermore, the entire thrust behind the objective standard is so that law enforcement officers can act in the same manner in every situation without having to take the time to determine whether someone is awake or asleep or whether they can see them or not.
Can I just one follow-up here? And so in the articulation of the test, whether a reasonable person in the defendant's situation would feel he's free to leave, are you also suggesting that the feel he's free to leave is not really the important part, and the question is he really free to leave?
I would say yes, Your Honor. It is whether the person is free to leave. If you look at the language in Mendenhall, it talks about whether an individual is free to terminate the police encounter and walk away. Mr. Tate's car was completely blocked in. He could not terminate the police encounter and drive his car away. He was stuck.
Counsel, just to follow up on that, so how far does your argument go? How much awareness do you have to have? I mean, in other words, if your back is turned, I mean, your back is turned to the entire audience here, have they seized you?
Your Honor, this is something that I have contemplated in these arguments quite a bit, and I think that the important thing to think about in these situations is that the entire thrust of law in this country is meant to protect those who cannot protect themselves or have a lowered ability to protect themselves. And when an individual is asleep, they can't protect themselves. And therefore, the seizure has to be constitutional, just as it would if someone would be awake, because that person, just because that person is not aware does not mean that they haven't been seized.
Well, what if the defendant in this case was in the same position but was awake, but could not see the police officer? Would he still be seized under your argument?
I would say most certainly, Your Honor.
You're seized as long as there is some blocking, regardless of the state of the defendant.
I would state that you're seized so long as the police behavior rises to the level of a seizure, where there's either force or there's a show of authority and submission to the authority.
Okay, regardless of what the defendant is doing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning, Ms. Longden. Follow up with that? How do you respond then to the Hadari D when they say they need to submit to that show of authority?
Well, first of all, I would state that I don't think this case falls under the Hadari D line of reasoning. I think the Hadari D line of reasoning talks about a show of authority and a submission to that authority. Whereas completely boxing someone in and preventing them physically from moving would be under the force prong. But furthermore, I think that Hodari D is somewhat of an aberration. The whole thrust of the Fourth Amendment seizure law protects someone's liberty interest. Also, the distinction with Hodari D is that someone who is running, and that's not at all a factor in this case.
Well, aren't you assuming, though, that he would drive to leave? Why couldn't he just open up the door and leave? I mean, I don't understand why just the physical presence of the police car the way it was makes any difference. I mean, the idea is that, you know, if he tried to leave, correct, I mean, if you look at the cases, and then was stopped, assuming that the policeman hadn't seen the open beer cans that would raised to reasonable suspicion, why isn't this person, as soon as he wakes up, free to leave? The reason is because there's evidence of a crime being committed, right? Mm-hmm. So he's not going to be, but by that time, there is reasonable suspicion. I think your premise is that blocking him is the seizure, but you can walk away, right? I mean, that would be an option, right? He could wake up and walk away.
I do understand the court's premise, but I think you have to take the situation as it is and stating that he was in a vehicle and his main way of leaving would be driving away in the vehicle. Furthermore, the blocking of my client's car is something that there is case law to back up that is a seizure. And there are some cases such as the Brown case in Colorado that shows that that's a seizure and it's a constitutional seizure when it's supported by reasonable suspicion. I would just state in this case it was not.
And so am I understanding your articulation of the test as involving two prongs, and either a show of force or a show of authority and submission to that authority under Hodari, mm-hmm. or simply use of force, in which case you're drawing a distinction where there's use of force, there need not be any even awareness of the use of force.
Is that? No, I would agree with the court on that. I think that
I'm trying to articulate your argument. Have I properly articulated?
Yes, you have, Your Honor.
Okay, so how do you square that though with the overarching test in Mendenhall that they're, I'm quoting from your brief, that a reasonable person would have believed that they were not free to leave. How does someone develop a belief if they're unaware of that show of force or the use of force?
I think the issue here is looking at the subjective state of mind, which is not part of the objective test. I think a reasonable person in viewing all the circumstances would have felt not free to leave because the car was completely blocked in. I find it to be a good example of talking about maybe a blind person or someone who has some disability to perceive reality as it is seen by other people. And when the police do a forcible seizure on those individuals, just because they can't perceive what's going on, does that mean that they haven't been seized? And I think they still have been seized. And I would equate that to a sleeping individual.
Could I follow up just on this point on Hodari D, the articulation of the standard? Do I recall correctly that the way Hodari reached the conclusion that it did, that there has to be an actual limitation on your freedom, you have to have actually physically been seized, was only by first deciding that the Mendenhall standard, or the standard that we had understood up to that point, was a necessary but not sufficient condition for a stop, and that actual force or stopping was necessary for it to be sufficient. But in getting there, didn't they say that a belief that you are not free to leave is a necessary, although not a sufficient condition? And does your argument seem to be writing out it being a condition at all?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that it's no longer a condition at all. I just think that when viewed from an objective standpoint, the circumstances of the seizure in this case would lead a reasonable person to believe that they were not free to leave. And opening up the black box of the actual individual's head who is being seized is exactly what the case law tells us not to do. And I would state that so that belief comes from a reasonable, objective person.
And just to bring you back to my original question, make sure we're on the same wavelength here. So, but by a reasonable person would feel he's not free to leave, you mean not a reasonable sleeping person? We shouldn't take into account the fact that the individual involved is sleeping.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, your concern is that police officers shouldn't really be tasked with having to decide whether somebody is awake or not awake or unconscious or drunk or sort of drunk. What that person's mental status is, they should just treat everyone as a, quote, reasonable person and act constitutionally according to that.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the assumption behind that, of course, is that a reasonable person is an awake person.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if we trace that back, do we know that somehow from some case law, or is that just intuitive that a reasonable person is awake and not drunk, conscious? Or where are we getting that kind of underlining assumption to all of this argument?
I can't point the court to a direct case. I will concede that. However, I would state that I think there is case law supporting the fact that you are not supposed to go into subjectively looking at either the police officer or the defendant's state of mind when you're looking into this. And to follow up on what the court stated about creating a consistent standard for police officers, I think that's the important thing here. But no, I don't have much.
Well, it probably doesn't make sense to assume a reasonable person is a drunk person or a reasonable person is an asleep person.
Right.
I mean, we really haven't been asked those kinds of questions before.
I don't think we have either, Your Honor.
But if we have a police officer coming up to this apartment, and I guess this this gentleman, the defendant, was slumped, is that right? Do I remember the facts correctly? The police officer could see him a little bit, but not very much.
Your Honor, the only thing I can point the court to from the motions hearing transcript is the officer observed a black male who was sleeping behind the driver's seat of a vehicle.
With the engine running?
Yes, Your Honor, it was idling.
So it's a conclusion that he observed him asleep?
That is what the motions hearing transcript does seem to bear out.
If he didn't know one way or the other, would it make a difference? I mean, or do we even have to be concerned about what was in the police officer's mind? We're not concerned about his subjective status either, really, are we?
No, we're not, Your Honor. I don't think that the Supreme Court case law, the United States Supreme Court case law, allows us to look into the subjective intent of the officer unless it's communicated.
So objectively, all we really know is the police car drove up. Car was parked, bound on three sides. There was somebody in that car, and the car was running.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then our question is, what should the police officer do in that kind of a circumstance?
I think the trial court correctly stated in the motions hearing transcript that a welfare check would be completely permissible in these situations had the officer parked somewhere else. The sum total of the issue is the actual seizure occurred without reasonable suspicion. Had the officer, say, parked 10 feet away and walked up to the vehicle, I don't think we'd be in front of the court.
Now, what if the officer had parked behind the vehicle and then said, you know, I was really worried about this person, so I was going to perform a welfare check?
I think that there is grounds for an emergency exception in certain cases. I don't believe that this rises to the level of an emergency exception, Your Honor, if that's what the court is getting.
And in that, to that extent, we have to know what was in the officer's mind.
Not necessarily.
I intended to do a welfare check, and that's not what the facts are here.
Well, the officer actually did state that he was concerned about my client's welfare, and that was why he parked there and walked up to the vehicle. So I do believe we have some testimony as to that intent. But again, just looking at the bare facts from an objective test, I would state that there was not reasonable suspicion and there was not evidence sufficient to warrant an emergency exception to the reasonable suspicion requirement.
Well, he could have suffered a heart attack. I mean, you're assuming that, you know, that he was totally all right. I mean, I'm a little bit concerned that just the parking location of this car becomes the pivot of this entire argument, whereas if it's a welfare check, the car's running, somebody's slumped over, it easily could be a heart attack. Something where he needed to park and get out there as fast as he could, and resuscitation, call 911, or whatever.
But for some reason, this case didn't become a case of whether or not this was a welfare check. And I'm curious why that happened. This was an appeal that started in the county court and went to the district court.
Yes, Your Honor.
The district court was sitting as the appellate court. So we don't have perhaps as complete of a record as we would had it started in the district court. But what exactly were the facts with respect to that, to the best of your recollection?
The bare facts from the motions hearing transcript, Your Honor, are that Officer Benda was driving through a residential apartment complex parking lot quite early in the morning. It was dark out. There had been recent reports of burglaries in the area. However, there had been no specific reports on the date in question. He observed a running car in a parking space that was bounded, again, by three cars. And he observed an individual sleeping in that vehicle, and the vehicle was on.
And you're sure he saw the person was asleep?
That is what the motions hearing transcript bears out. I was not the litigant at the motions hearing.
I wanted to just make sure that that was what you intended to say.
Yes, Your Honor. And then he parked behind Mr. Tate's vehicle, perpendicular to it, completely blocking it in. The officer actually states there was basically no way the car could have moved. And at that point, he turned on his spotlights into the vehicle. And then he walked up to the door, observed the sleeping man, Mr. Tate, observed some beer cans, and then tapped on the window. The window was rolled down eventually, and he smelled an odor of alcohol. And as I stated before, I would concede there was definitely reasonable suspicion at that point.
Excuse me, but he did see the person when he illuminated the light and he approached the car to check on the welfare of the driver, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and I guess the parking of the car gives me some concern because, you know, now many months later we're able to look back and see that it was somebody who was intoxicated, and the remedy is to suppress all of the evidence and say bad police officer. But if the person's had a heart attack and he saves his life, he gets a medal, and it's exactly the same conduct. Can you help me separate those two?
Your Honor, I would still state, even if the person was having a heart attack, it would still be an unconstitutional seizure. There is a procedure for a welfare check, and no one is debating, certainly not co-counsel and I, that there was not a permissible reason for a welfare check in this case. However, a welfare check can't go hand in hand with a seizure. And the bare fact that there was a seizure is the issue, because a seizure has to be supported by reasonable suspicion, and this one was not. A welfare check, as long as there's no seizure, doesn't have to be supported by reasonable suspicion.
I didn't quite hear the last part of your answer, because the testimony is pretty clear that he says, I parked, got out of my vehicle, I approached the driver's side of the vehicle to check on the welfare of the occupants. Now, what was your answer to Justice Boatwright?
Your Honor, I stated that a welfare check would be permissible had he parked somewhere else, because there was a seizure in this case, and a welfare check does not have to be supported by reasonable suspicion. However, a seizure does. And respectfully, Your Honor, Mr. Chief Justice and the court, I would ask to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Andrew Cooper, 23036. I'm here on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. At least where there is no physical grasping of a defendant, a police show of authority does not effectuate a Fourth Amendment seizure if the defendant is completely unaware of any police presence. Starting with the language of the Fourth Amendment, the word seizure readily bears the meaning of physical grasping, and it has long been understood to also bear the meaning of a police show of authority, which on a reasonable person would have the equivalent of physical grasping by causing that person to feel as though they could not leave or could not disregard the officer's commands. The question today is whether we should expand the meaning of the word seizure even further to include circumstances where there is some police conduct about which a person is completely unaware, and have that mean a seizure as well. Our answer to that question is that the word should not be expanded further. There are municipal ordinances and—
I'm sorry to interrupt you before you kind of get into the part of your argument, but that would be a really tough thing. I mean, here, the defendant was asleep in his car. Somebody tapped on his window. He woke up. At that moment, he probably would have realized he was seized. And a nanosecond later, or maybe simultaneously, the police officer would have smelled the alcohol and realized he had reasonable suspicion, right? So I mean, you're almost splitting hairs in a sense, are you not?
In this instance, once the officer was alongside the vehicle, but while the driver was still sleeping, the officer could see the beer cans. And I think it's agreed that at that point, there was reasonable suspicion to justify a seizure.
But But wasn't what was important about the beer cans is that they were open and there was a smell of alcohol? And we don't know any of these facts from this county court record, but I'm assuming that there was this tap on the window went down, the alcohol smell came out, boom, we had reasonable suspicion.
The alcohol smell comes out after the door is open, and I think it's agreed that at that point, the person has already been seized. So I don't think that...
Yeah, he had to be awake to be seized, according to your argument.
Correct. Correct. And one reason for that...
Well, let me ask you this, then. Was he seized before there was reasonable suspicion? If it was the smell that created reasonable suspicion?
Your Honor, if he had been awake and aware of the officer parking the vehicle, patrol car behind his vehicle and shining a spotlight into the vehicle and the officer approaching alongside, we have conceded that if the driver had been aware of those three things, the positioning of the patrol car, the shining of the spotlight, and the approach to the vehicle, that he would have been seized. We've conceded that in our briefing of the district court. So the sole issue is whether it turns on his awareness.
Why? I'm taking too much of your time. I'm going to ask one more question. Why does it matter whether he was aware of the shining of the spotlight and the approach of the officer? Why isn't simply the parking of the car, the police patrol car behind his, enough?
Because a person has no legal obligation to comply with an officer's orders if the person is unaware of those orders. Aurora has a municipal ordinance. It's section 94-110, subsection A5, which makes it illegal for a person to disobey an order. But that offense, like other similar municipal offenses and some state statutes like resisting arrest and refusing to aid an officer, those are all knowing offenses, which means that a person cannot be convicted of refusing to comply with an officer's order or any of those other types of statutes unless the person is aware of the officer's order. And if a person has no legal obligation to comply with an officer's directions, unless he's aware of those directions, then a reasonable person, for the purpose of the Fourth Amendment seizure analysis, who is unaware of the officer's presence, can't feel as though he is unable to disregard the commands.
Go ahead.
Mr. Cooper, you just used the test, a reasonable, innocent person. Focusing on that language, that obviously implies an objective test, right? Subjective, isn't it? An objective test about what a reasonable, innocent person would feel freedom of movement curtailed, correct?
Yes, it's objective, not subjective.
So by focusing on whether or not this person was conscious, aren't you really changing that test and making it subjective depending on the specific circumstances?
Well, we're not, because a person whether a person is asleep is an objectively discernible fact. Humans sleep with their eyes closed. They cannot see through closed eyelids. Those are objective facts.
Not necessarily. I mean, the person could be sitting in his car with his head back, his eyes closed, and listening to music on an iPod and appear to be asleep and be perfectly awake.
That's true, and let me address that. You could imagine a scenario where the officer honestly believed that the person was asleep, but the person, in fact, was not asleep. And then we'd have a suppression hearing where the officer would testify, well, I approached him on a welfare check theory or on a reasonable suspicion for a DUI theory because it looked like he was asleep behind the wheel of a car where the motor was running. And then the defendant at the suppression hearing could testify, well, it may have looked to the officer like it was asleep, but actually I just barely had my eyes closed and I could see him approaching. And on that set of facts, I would agree that it is a seizure, because in that scenario he is aware of it.
And I guess what troubles me,
go ahead, sorry.
I suppose what troubles me a little bit about that is in your view, this whole thing then turns on whether the defendant just happened to be aware of the police officer's presence and the showing of the lights and pulling up behind this parked car. And how do we square that with the notion, and your opposing counsel kind of raised this point, with the idea that the exclusionary rule is to deter bad police conduct? And in this case, you've got the same police conduct pulling up, parking behind a parked car, and the whole thing then turns on whether the defendant happens to be awake. So if the officer gets lucky and the defendant really was asleep, there's no Fourth Amendment violation. But I guess I'm worried about the message or the if the whole point of this is to establish rules for police officers, what is the message being given here?
Well, that's not the whole point of this. And Hodari D. answers that question, because in the United States Supreme Court case of Hodari D., the officers were chasing a person without a legitimate basis for doing so, and were trying to seize that person without reasonable suspicion, but the person did not submit. And the Hodari D. said it wasn't a Fourth Amendment seizure, because one of the aspects of the analysis is whether the person submitted. The Fourth Amendment does not proscribe all unreasonable police conduct. It proscribes unreasonable searches and seizures. If you think about the universe of possible unreasonable police conduct, it includes things that are not searches and seizures. Some of those other types of conduct are proscribed by other constitutional provisions. They might be prescribed by statutes or by police policy, but they're not prescribed by the Fourth Amendment unless it's a search or seizure. Let me address.
Before you get too far away from that, let me jump in a second on this subject versus objective test. We have this problem in a lot of areas where we, in effect, objectivize a subjective test. So you're clearly conceding, or you're understanding the standard to be not what the defendant himself knew or understood or felt, but rather what a reasonable person in his situation would understand. But then we're sort of always faced with the question of, well, how much of his circumstances do we treat as being part of the reasonable person test? Now, I've started to hear you try to formulate a rule there about being objectively discernible. So your opponent would like to leave out the fact that the individual in this case was asleep, that shouldn't factor in to the question of what a reasonable person would be like, because we're not talking about a reasonable sleeping person, even though this person was asleep. You, on the other hand, say, no, you can determine that this individual was asleep, so we're only talking about a reasonable person who was in the same circumstances. How far do we carry that? I mean, you could envision a situation in which, I suppose, that in which the individual in the car was another police officer or something such that he would not feel that he was not free to leave just because an officer pulled up behind him. How much of the characteristics of the actual individual do we take into account in our objective standard?
Well, I think under the case law, it's clear that individual characteristics such as their fearfulness of the police are out of the picture. That's purely a subjective analysis.
What about just disabilities?
Well, that's where the analysis, I would agree, would become trickier, like someone who is blind and therefore does not see him, or someone who's deaf and does not hear the commands. That's trickier simply because it involves individual characteristics. But I think even in those situations, if those individual characteristics are objectively discernible, then you could have a situation where the person is not seized because being blind and unable to see, the person is unaware of the police presence. But those are trickier questions because they involve individual characteristics.
So to get back to Justice Coates' question, we don't consider that because this guy was asleep?
Well, sleep is a more universal characteristic. We all sleep, except for me last night. I didn't sleep. But for those of us, we all know that when we're asleep, we're not aware of what's going around. And that's a universal characteristic. And likewise, if your back is turned to the officer, that's a universal characteristic. Some of these cases from the other jurisdictions where the person is looking down when the patrol car pulls behind them, the person clearly can't see in that situation. And the analysis becomes more difficult, I think, only when you have individual characteristics that prevent that particular person. But to think about a Miranda case, a recent Miranda case, and Miranda, I understand, is a different analysis, but a person can't be in custody for purposes of Miranda unless they're at least subjected to a Fourth Amendment seizure. You know, I think it was last year, JDB versus North Carolina was decided on the issue of whether the fact that a juvenile is underage is a factor that should be considered in whether the person is in custody for purposes of Miranda. And part of the reasoning of the U.S. Supreme Court in that is that whether the person, well, the juvenile's age is objectively discernible. So that is an example of an individual characteristic that is objectively discernible, even though it would vary from individual to individual. I want to talk about a situation where the defense argument and the county court analysis in this case infringes on individual liberties, because the position that I'm advocating is not one that purely is useful to the prosecution in a case like this. Although there are some cases like this one where the defense argues that a seizure has occurred at an early point before there's legal justification for the seizure, there are also situations where it is the police or the prosecution who maintain that a seizure has occurred at an early stage. And that happens when there is a search and the police seek to justify it as a search incident to arrest. And the test of that arrest, an arrest is one form of Fourth Amendment seizure that involves a greater degree of restraint than an investigatory detention of this type. But in scenarios where the police search someone and then seek to justify that search as a search incident to arrest, it's the police who would be arguing that seizure already happened. And if the person was unaware of that seizure, then that's a situation where it would actually infringe on the individual liberty. And I can see from furrowed brows that I'm not making myself clear. So let me give sort of a comic example of this, okay? Suppose the police have probable cause to arrest someone who happens to be sleeping on a park bench. They don't want to arrest the person. Well, they don't want to charge the person with a crime yet because they don't have enough evidence and they want more evidence. So they go up to the sleeping person on the park bench and they whisper to him, "Hey buddy, you're under arrest." And say that quietly enough that the person doesn't hear it. And then the police rifle through the person's pockets. Don't find anything that day and say to them, "Okay, you're free to go. We'll be back tomorrow to do this again." And the person remains asleep. Now that's sort of a comic example, but it's a situation in which under the county court's analysis that a person is seized even though he's unaware of it, that's a situation where the police would be able to justifiably conduct a search incident to arrest on the theory that they have arrested that person by communicating to him that the person is under arrest even though they're unaware of it. So it's not just, this analysis is not just one that is useful to the prosecution in this instance, it's one that affects the Fourth Amendment analysis in a broad range of cases.
Mr. Cooper, let me ask you a question. Why isn't this case resolvable, not on this deep philosophical issue about whether or not a tree falls in the forest, and whether you can be aware of something, and whether that constitutes a seizure, simply on the fact that Justice Hobbs kind of suggested it in his questions of defense counsel, that this officer did a welfare check and had to act quickly, period, where you don't need to worry about these issues.
Sure.
Why don't you argue that? Why not?
Well, analytically, we should not reach the question of whether police conduct was justifiable unless there was a seizure. In my view, a welfare check can sometimes be effectuated through a consensual encounter, And sometimes it's effectuated through a search, if the police are going into somebody's home looking for possibly injured people, or through a seizure. So it's an alternative justification for a seizure, just as reasonable suspicion is. But the court shouldn't reach the question of whether something was justified if, in fact, it didn't occur and there is no seizure.
Well, so you don't like that argument.
I don't like that argument, Your Honor. And in 2008, this
court... Well, we'll go to another one.
I want to ask a question about that. You, in your response to the request for cert, on the petition for certiorari, in your response, I think you wrote that, was very unusual in the fact that you said, Supreme Court, will you please take this case? Because there are so many situations like this where people are asleep and the police officers don't know what to do. And we really are looking to you, the court, to try to help us in this area. Is my recollection correct?
No, that's accurate. But there's two dimensions to the issue. And I think really the more important issue is whether it is a seizure.
Do you want this question to focus on sleeping people? I mean, is that?
I want it to focus on whether there's a seizure by a police show of authority about which the person is completely unaware, because it has application to cases beyond just the sleeping person. Sometimes the police just follow someone. Sometimes there's clandestine surveillance for weeks that would cause a person to be seized, and sometimes that surveillance is initiated on less than reasonable suspicion. The police have a hunch. Sometimes the police have a hunch that someone that they're looking for is in a particular house, so they set up a perimeter and wait. And if during that time they find evidence of something, that person in the house who's completely unaware of the police presence should not be able to successfully move to suppress that evidence, saying, well, there were all these police around here. I wasn't aware of it at the time, but if I had been, I would have been seized. So that police conduct was unconstitutional. The implications of this are very significant. The teaching of a lot of our Fourth Amendment jurisprudence is that the police should take their time. A lot of times where evidence gets suppressed under the Fourth Amendment, it's because the police have acted too quickly.
Well, wait a second, Mr. Cooper, you're dealing with a lot of facts that you just mentioned, and some of them have to do with trespass, some of them have to do with the right of privacy. I mean, you know, we're not in the business, really, of writing textbook answers with a lot of dicta, right?
Well, and I'm not asking that the court do that. I'm asking that the court decide on these facts that this particular individual was not seized. But I think that an opinion that instead looked at whether there was some justification for the conduct would cause confusion for the lower courts, because they would look at scenarios like a perimeter around the home or clandestine surveillance, and defendants in those cases would cite the Tate case and say, well, you should assess whether there's reasonable suspicion.
Well, arising out of these facts, then what would you like our holding to be? If you were writing this opinion, what do you want us to say?
Sure. I would say that because this defendant was asleep and therefore unaware of the officer's approach, he was not seized for purposes of the Fourth Amendment. I would say that it's been recognized that the prosecution has conceded that if this person was aware of the patrol car's position and the spotlight being shown in and the officer's approach, that he would have been seized, but that because he was not aware of it, on the uncontroverted facts, there was no seizure. And then I would ask the court not address the second question as to whether it would be justified.
Can I just ask you a factual question? I seem to recall, maybe this is wrong, but I thought Ms. Longton said this as well. I didn't think the officer shined his flashlight, his head. When he stopped and got out of the car, I don't think the headlight was on. The spotlight was on. It was on when he came up close to the passenger side or the driver's side. That's my recollection of the facts. Is that wrong?
My recollection of the facts is that the patrol car stops behind the car, the spotlight is shined in, and it's through the aid of the spotlight, not the overhead rotating lights, but a spotlight into the vehicle, that the officer is able to see that this person is asleep, and then the officer makes his approach.
Well, we have just a He says, I park, you're right, that is. He said, I park behind the vehicle and place my spotlight on the green Ford Explorer. That's correct.
Yeah, it's page 11.
I always get confused by these cases where you're presuming now that it would be a seizure if he'd been awake. I'm still having trouble with the initiation of consensual encounters, which you would agree officers do all the time. And, you know, for instance, the famous Conley case, right, in Denver, the officer goes up, he's armed, right, talks to a man on the street, and the guy engages in a conversation, and he doesn't have to give a Miranda warning there because the guy is free to leave, right? I'm concerned that in your concession, your wish that we would get this point of law settled, that we're missing consensual encounter opportunities that are actually in the health and safety interests of people to have occur.
Well, sure. And there's case law that an officer can approach a parked vehicle and even tap on the window and get the person's attention without it being a seizure, because those are things that private citizens might do if they want to talk to somebody who's in an adjacent car. And I don't think, so that by itself I don't think would be a seizure. I don't think the positioning of the car would be a seizure, because in a crowded parking lot we're accustomed to cars temporarily blocking us in if the person has been aware of it. But I think the signing of the spotlight is more significant.
It's night, the motor's running, the guy slumped over. You know, how do you see what condition the person's in if you're a police officer acting reasonably trying to initiate a welfare check without doing those things?
And let me answer that question this way. If we had the scenario that I think Justice Marquez alluded to, which was a person who looks like they're asleep, but turns out that they're awake, and therefore we have a seizure, and so we have to address that question about whether the seizure was justified by a welfare check. If this was that set of facts, I would say, well, this conduct is obviously reasonable. It's very reasonable as a welfare check. The police car should be positioned there closely so that the officer can quickly come to the person's aid and check them out. If the person is in distress, any safety equipment that the officer would have in the patrol car would be nearby. So there's lots of reasons to put that car right there, and it makes perfect sense to shine the light in, and it makes perfect sense to approach the person, both on a welfare check theory and on a reasonable suspicion for DUI theory.
But I thought under what you wanted us to say, this awareness, the person who had the earphones on and was listening to the iPhone or the music, the iTunes, wouldn't have that awareness.
Well, and yes, I don't want the court to reach the question that Justice Hobbs has asked about. But that's my answer to Justice Hobbs' question. And
my question is, the way you wanted to formulate our holding, if I remember correctly, just looking at that, is you want this analysis to turn on awareness.
Yes.
All right. So Justice Marquez is, zoned out listening to music person would not have an awareness.
Oh, well, and I apologize if I was confused about the question. My understanding of Justice Marquez's question was a driver who looks to the officer like they're asleep, but in fact they're awake, slumping.
So you don't really want us to make a decision depending on how loud the music was and whether their eyes were closed, so they weren't able to notice what was happening around them, versus sort of only partially listening to the music with your eyes sort of half open?
Well, and I might have missed the earphone dimension of the question. I was thinking more in terms of someone who just looks like they're asleep, but actually they're playing possum and they're actually awake, or they have their eyes closed and they're resting, but they're through partly opened eyes, they see the officer's approach. That would be a scenario where if the defendant testified to that at the suppression hearing, and the defendant does have the burden of establishing a seizure, that's People versus Trelanton from, I think, 2008, and Rakus versus Illinois, they have the burden of establishing that seizure. He should testify to that. If the officer is testifying that, well, this person was asleep and therefore unaware, the defendant can testify, and his testimony would be inadmissible at trial in the People's Case in Chief under Simmons versus United States. So the defendant needs to say that and say, I was aware of this. And then we'd have the scenario where we'd need to address Justice Hobbs's question, which is, was the officer's conduct
Could I take you back real quick to the second question again that you sort of have dodged in our petition, arguing that we shouldn't address it. I take it that question is actually broad enough to mean, assuming that the person is asleep, and we're not changing the situation here, but if we were to decide that that is a factor to be taken into account in the stop, and therefore that the defendant in this case was stopped, we still have the question, was there reasonable suspicion for the stop at the moment the officer saw someone sleeping or unconscious in a car with the motor running? And I'm not sure if you've answered that. I haven't understood that you have, and I'd like to know what your thought is about that.
If I'm understanding your question, my thought is that if I lose on the seizure issue, you should remand it to the district court.
And why would that be? Why is that not a question we could decide? Quite apart from any additional facts, just simply on the broad question, which also seems to me to be one that is not insignificant, does an officer have reasonable suspicion for a stop of someone he sees unconscious or sleeping in a running vehicle?
And
we don't have to get into welfare check. Let's address it. Is that reasonable suspicion for a stop?
I believe that it is.
I'm sorry, you believe it is?
I believe that it's absolutely reasonable suspicion for a stop if the person is asleep behind the wheel of a running car.
And therefore, although you'd like us to address the question whether this was actually a seizure, you're also taking the position that in any event, the officers had reasonable grounds to stop this person at the moment they pulled up and parked their car behind you.
Absolutely, but again, I think it will create confusion for the lower courts if you say this was not a seizure, but nonetheless, it's justified.
Well, of course, you may have a different thought on this, but from my point of view, I'm having trouble seeing why we would be obliged to address the one question rather than the other.
Well, in People versus Marujo, a 2008 case issued by this court, the question was whether the person was seized, and having answered that question, that it was a consensual encounter, the court said, we therefore don't need to address the question whether there's reasonable suspicion.
And would it work the same way for us to say, if we can determine this person, that the police had reasonable grounds for a seizure at the moment they pulled up behind him, we don't have to get into the refined question of whether they actually did perform a seizure at that point? Is it not a fairly, as you pointed out, one of the problems with officers and stops is deciding whether they act too quickly. So there is always the problem of deciding exactly when did the stop occur. But if there was grounds for the stop from even the earliest point at which it might have occurred, is that not a reasonable way to resolve the case?
I don't think that's the way the court should resolve the case, because I think analytically the first question is, was there a seizure? If there was no seizure, then the Fourth Amendment is not implicated and there is no need to address whether the police conduct.
Actually, Chief, if I may ask one quick follow-up question. I'm a little confused now by your last response about reasonable suspicion. I thought, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that the state had conceded that, in fact, if the parking the car behind the defendant's parked vehicle constituted a seizure, there was no reasonable suspicion of criminal conduct for that activity that would justify that seizure. And if I'm incorrect about that, what reasonable suspicion of what criminal activity would be the basis for that stop based on someone sleeping in a parked car?
My concession was that if the driver had been aware of the officers positioning the vehicle, shining the spotlight, and approaching the vehicle, there would have been a seizure. I did not concede that there would be, there would not be reasonable suspicion.
But what would the reasonable suspicion of what criminal activity then under those circumstances?
You know what, I think the principal one would be driving under the influence of alcohol, but I would suggest another one as well.
What objective observation by the officer at that juncture would justify reasonable suspicion for DUI just based on someone sleeping in a parked car?
Well, it's not just sleeping in a parked car. It's sleeping in a parked car with a motor running at 4:30 in the morning. That's unusual. That's not something.
In February, trying to keep warm, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, I'm just curious.
People versus Brown stated explicitly, and that was a we've cited that in our brief. There were some other facts there, but the statement of the case was that those particular facts, running engine, sleeping driver behind the wheel, is justification for investigation, a temporary detention for DUI investigation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Rebuttal?
May it please counsel, may it please the court. My name is Nicholas Sarwark, registration number 40608 on behalf of Mr. Tate. I'd like to address a couple of the issues that were raised by the prosecution in this case. The test that the people are asking the court to adopt is a test that's only been adopted in two other states. It's been adopted in Florida, two cases out of their courts, and one case out of an Idaho case, or Idaho courts. That test says that unless a person is aware that the police have seized him, the seizure is per se reasonable. The prosecution couches it as an objective test, that what we're looking at is an objective sleeping person. But an objective sleeping person is no test at all, because an objective sleeping person can never be aware of a seizure. And so the outcome of adopting the test that's only been adopted in two other jurisdictions is that the Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable seizure falls away anytime you go to sleep. There's no other Fourth Amendment protection that falls away anytime you go to sleep. When you go to sleep in your house, you don't lose the protection against an unreasonable search. Likewise, it moves away from the objective test that's been established by the U.S. Supreme Court through Terry, Mendenhall, and Chesternut, that the question is, from a reasonable person standard, whether or not police behavior is reasonable or not. And that's a question for law enforcement. And the reason that the Supreme Court of the United States wants clear rules for whether or not there's a seizure is to provide clear guidance to law enforcement. In the cases cited by the prosecution in their brief from Florida, you have encounters in which police pull up behind a vehicle, they put on their lights, they effectively seize, and it's conceded by those courts if the person's aware that they're back there, they are seized. And you have this situation where due to the unawareness, the person's not seized, the person's not seized, and until the police officer gets to the passenger window, looks in and sees the person, and the person looks up and goes, there's a police officer, that's when the seizure happens. But if the trial court in those cases believes that the person's aware that the police are approaching the vehicle from behind, then you have an unreasonable seizure that's violative of the constitutional right.
Counsel, you phrased the question in terms of losing your protection against seizure. But wouldn't it be just as fair to characterize that as whether the person has been seized at all, given the constitutional definition of seizure?
You could phrase it that way, Your Honor, but the effect is the same. There is no protection against seizure for a sleeping person under the test articulated by the prosecution.
Well, if you phrased it the second way, there would be protection against being seized. It's just you're not seized unless you are aware of it.
I would agree with that if you phrase it that way. The problem with that test, and the prosecution responded, I think, to Justice Rice, your question regarding awareness, that their holding would be an awareness holding similar to the Florida line of cases. The problem with that test is it devolves a suppression hearing at the trial court into a swearing contest. If you read those cases closely, these issues of whether or not the person in the vehicle was aware of whether or not the police were approaching them or had seized them is a contested issue. And it just comes down to which side do you believe? It also encourages a different kind of police behavior depending on what they can articulate. But not only does it affect the sleeping person as Mr. Tate in this case, but if you follow that rule of awareness, it actually encourages something like Justice Marquez's hypothetical, where police would be encouraged to approach vehicles in a way that they couldn't be seen, knowing that their behavior isn't a seizure until they're noticed.
Can I just follow up?
Sure.
I appreciate the sort of anomaly that you're presenting, but given the case law as it exists from the United States Supreme Court, particularly Hodari D, once we reach that point, is it not true that officers, according to the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of the Fourth Amendment, are permitted to chase a suspect without any suspicion whatsoever, as long as they don't catch him before they get the suspicion?
Yes, Your Honor. And Hodari D is good case law, but it is case law that applies to a fleeing defendant. It is case law that applies to a physical grasping. This set of circumstances is more properly analyzed under Terry, under Mendenhall, and under Florida v. Bostick, in which you have, in effect, a physical seizure of the vehicle. The vehicle's not going anywhere under the facts of this case. You have that seizure, you don't have a show of submission because that's not what happens when you stop a vehicle. You don't have somebody raise their hands up or get out of the car. What happens is they don't go anywhere. And that's the reason that you have the reasonable person standard, because you can't, jurisprudentially, you can't have these suppression hearings where you're constantly having people in cars testify, what was I thinking sitting in a driver's seat? That's not going to provide any guidance to law enforcement to know what conduct is and isn't constitutional. To address a question Justice Hobbs had about the welfare check and the slumping, the reading of the record in this case is there was not slumping. In People v. Brown, there was slumping. That was a Colorado case in which a car had basically crashed and there were three people slumped over, and that was where we found this emergency exception where a seizure for a welfare check is justified. What is not justified under the Constitution is a scenario in which police officers can go through any parking lot in the state of Colorado and stop behind any running vehicle to see whether or not anyone's having a heart attack, because it would, again, encourage this behavior that isn't articulated by any suspicion, just let's check every car that's running to see if that person is in physical peril or alternatively is intoxicated.
Mr. Sarwick, let me ask, you keep referring to the prosecution's standard. What is your definition? What do you think the definition is of a seizure?
The definition of a seizure is when a person's liberty interest, their ability to leave the encounter, to terminate the encounter, is terminated from the perspective of a reasonable, objective, an objective reasonable person standard, in this case, a reasonable awake person.
So they believe or they feel they can leave, correct? Or that, not leave?
That a reasonable awake person in that situation would feel that they could leave or not leave.
Okay, but the word feel is significant. How can an unconscious person feel anything?
And the reason that we have the objective test and not the subjective test is so that this question of what the person actually felt doesn't come to the courts. It's the question of what a reasonable awake person would feel. So our position is not reading the feeling or the belief aspect of the Fourth Amendment test out of it, but that needs to be objective pursuant to Terry, Mendenhall, and Chesternut.
Thank you, Mr. Sir.
So is your position only consistent with Ms. Longdon's position? I thought she conceded that this could be a welfare check.
Your Honor, we are conceding that the contact at the window could be a welfare check, but the seizure
of the car
cannot be authorized as a seizure pursuant to Brown.
And the distinction you make is because the driver was sleeping at the wheel as opposed to slumped at the wheel.
Yes, Your Honor. Looking at the Brown case, there are a number of other.
I thought the distinction you made was that if the officer parked his car someplace else, he could then go up to the window.
If the officer had not seized the vehicle by parking behind it, then any welfare check or investigatory contact would be consensual. But given that the officer did park behind the vehicle and create a seizure, then that needs to be analyzed under the Brown exception, where there's clear objective facts that show that there is a type of emergency.
So just to follow up on the Chief Justice's question, there is no way there could be a welfare question from your opinion here since the officer did park behind the defendant's car. there was a seizure?
Yes, Your Honor.
At that point. Okay.
Thank you.
Any further? Thank you. I want to thank both attorneys for your briefs, your argument. The case is submitted.